I draw a very sharp distinction between Muslim and Islamic. So in my view, there's no such thing as an Islamic terrorist. There may be a such thing as a Muslim terrorist, that is, a terrorist who happens to be Muslim. Okay, a terrorist can happen to belong to any particular way of life, but if, just like you could have a Muslim thief, but that doesn't mean that Islam condones stealing. Just so happens that the thief was Muslim. So the expression Islamic terrorism is used in the media is something that I don't accept, because it's kind of, because what it does is it attaches the label of terrorist not to the person who does it, that is to the Muslim, but rather it attaches it to the religion itself, to Islam. And I believe that even though this is a subtle sleight of hand, I believe it's very significant in terms of the perceptions that people have. So I don't accept that there is a such thing as Islamic terrorism. That being said, and this expands on something I said a little earlier, the Prophet himself, the Prophet of Islam himself, was aware of the possible corruption of religion. And this is why he told his cousin and son-in-law, he said, you're going to have to fight three kinds of people. He told him this before he died. You're going to have to fight one kind of people who he called Nakithin, which in Arabic means those who untie the rope. And these were people who used their relationship with the Prophet, their wealth and their influence, in order to gain economic advantage over the society. Then he says you will have to fight the Qasitin, and these are like tyrants and oppressors. And these referred to people who had no real allegiance to Islam, but who wanted to rule and have control. And then he says, and then you will have to fight the Mariqin. And these were the people, he said, these are the people who fly from the way of Allah, the way an arrow flies from his bow. These are people who, they take the outer structure of Islam, absolutize it, and then condemn everybody else who do not follow it. So for example, you have a case where these people were like terrorists of their time. They used to, anyone who didn't understand their own conception of Islam, they said they could be killed, they could be hung, you know, much like the Inquisition in the Christian church. If you don't see it our way, then you have to be gotten rid of. So the Prophet warned his cousin and son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, he warned him that these three categories of people who will all claim allegiance to this religion, all three of these kind of people would come up. So you have people who, tyrants and rulers who use religion for their name, people who use religion to maintain economic power and control over people, and people who use religion as a rigid baseball bat to beat people over the head with and to kill whoever doesn't see anything their way, in a very narrow-minded kind of way. So Islam, like other ways of life, faces these kinds of dangers of people using Islam for these negative purposes. So that is really where the essence of this lies. So these people who are committing, you know, particularly violent acts in the name of Islam, and, you know, kidnapping people, beheading people, and so forth, these are not Islamic terrorists. These are misguided people who either out of frustration or desperation do things which you know, absolutely make no sense and do nothing for them or nothing for the people who they claim that they're interested in serving. Yes, Islam does call for the protection of one's homeland. It does call for the fighting for peace, justice, and human rights. But it calls for that within a certain moral context. And even in the case of war, Islam gives particular rules of war about how to treat women and children, how to treat non-combatants, and how to treat one another. So one of the particular problems that we face is an absolutization of certain external features of Islam on the part of certain individuals, which then creates a lot of the problems that we saw. Although I will add that even that we have to see in the larger context of global foreign policy and policies which engender these kinds of things. The example I like to give is like of anthrax. If you dig your hand in the ground and lift it, there will be anthrax in the dirt. So you can't avoid anthrax. It's everywhere. But if you bring it into the lab and extract it and multiply it, then it becomes a serious problem. So these kinds of tendencies you can find in any society. But the right or wrong policies will tend to cause these germs or viruses to grow and develop to a point where they cause a problem for everybody. You can't beat a dog, okay? You can't have a house with your wife and children and have a shed and beat a dog in it, and then if the dog one day digs from under the shed and becomes vicious because you kept beating him, and then he comes into the house and kills one of your children, and then you say, well, let's kill all dogs because this dog broke into my house and killed my children. Yeah, you have to kill that dog. You got to find the dog. You got to kill it just so it doesn't kill anybody else. But you also have a responsibility to ask the owner of the dog or the oppressor of the dog, why were you oppressing the dog? Why were you treating the dog this way? So you have to look at the entire context. Otherwise, you will only have... Otherwise, your analysis will be skewed as to why things happen the way they do.